John 11, verse 45. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. So what has Jesus just done? Let's have a quick recap. Someone remind us, not a rhetorical question, what has Jesus just done? It's very simple. Raise Lazarus. Brilliant, thank you. And that's the climactic seventh sign, miracle, and John's calling them signs, that he's been laying out for us ever since chapter 1, and they're escalating. And the reason he's calling them signs is that they signpost us to the real Jesus, which is the title of this series. They reveal who he really is, why he really came. And last week, as we watched Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead, we were shown, here's some of the stuff that was signed to us by it, that he's the Christ, God's long-promised king, that he has authority and power over death, that he gives life to those who trust in his death to pay for their sin and who hand their lives over to him. That's what it means in John's gospel, to believe in him. Hence, verse 45, many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But, and here's the first of just two simple points we have tonight. Alongside that wonderful belief, we also see self-serving opposition. And that's the first point. It's got two points. Number one, self-serving opposition. Let me read on, verse 46. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done, and not in a good way. You can tell their motives aren't good when they tell the Pharisees because of the contrast with verse 45. Many of the Jews believed, great, but some of them went to the Pharisees. So everyone say snitch after three. One, two, three, snitch, right. Reading on from verse 47. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council. And that council, that's the Sanhedrin or Hedron. By the way, the National Jewish Leadership Council over the nation within the limits which Rome allowed, verse 47. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council, like the Supreme Court almost, and said, what are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place, by which they mean the temple, slash their own position in Jewish society, and our nation. So first of all, notice what they don't say. And here's just the first fascinating thing, if you look closely. Or to put it another way, notice what they admit in passing. They don't say, Jesus is a fraud. They don't say, he's not the real deal. His signs are false. They admit in passing his signs are real. It is so funny to me today that liberals will bend over backwards, do all kinds of crazy mental and hermeneutical gymnastics, epistemological gymnastics, to avoid admitting that Jesus really did real miracles, when even Jesus' worst enemies at the time can't deny it. And in verse 48, their concern is that if Jesus is left unchecked, there'll be this Jewish uprising against the Romans by Jesus' followers, which the Romans will crush, and that could spell the end of their position and the temple and their whole nation. Now, that wasn't true. Jesus had always been at pains to reject any idea that he's merely just a little political messiah or military messiah. As he taught, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and render unto God the things that are God's. So he's not going after a small fry as liberating Israel from the Romans in first century Judea. This concern of the Pharisees that Jesus might spark an uprising that would then be crushed, that was an excuse for them to get him stopped. So here's the question. Why did they really want him stopped? Why did they really want him stopped? And we get a glimpse of the truth when we look in verse 48 at the look at the word before place and look at the word before nation. It's kind of a slightly strange way that they put it, and it's a bit of a slip, I think. The word before place and the word before nation in verse 48. I'm not going to say it. I'd love each of you to see it for yourselves. they're not really thinking of the temple. They're not really thinking of the nation. They're thinking of themselves. They're jealous to protect their own power, their own prestige, their own privilege, their own influence, their own status. And so idolatrous are they over their power and prestige and privilege and status and influence in Israel, they're not going to let anyone replace them as top dog, not even the Son of God. Like, the nation was given to them in trust until the Messiah comes. They've so grown comfortable in that position that when he does come, there's no way they're handing it back to him, even if he is its rightful owner. I remember once seeing a comedy sketch, and apologies if this is slightly dark, very dry British humor, but this comedy sketch on TV was about the staff members of a charity that's raising money to find a cure for cancer. And one of the staff members is dressed up as like a big goofy animal. He's just been fundraising in the local mall or whatever. And he's with the accountant and the secretary and the CEO and a few of the other workers. And they're all sitting around having coffee in the office. And then someone bursts in and says, "Have you heard the news? It's been announced. Scientists have found a cure for cancer." And they stare at each other and their heads drop in disbelief. And one of them says, "Yay." And then the guy who brought the message takes a call on his phone, has a quick conversation, puts it down and says, "Guys, I'm so sorry. Made a terrible mistake. They actually haven't found the cure for cancer." And all the staff are suddenly very chipper. "Oh, well, never mind. On we go. On we go." You can see where their hearts really were. They didn't want to be done out of a job or out of an identity. The Jewish leaders are like those staff workers. It's British humor. Don't worry about it. Let's pretend it wasn't even a joke. It's a good illustration, though. The whole point of the Jewish leaders was to be ready for the Messiah when he arrived and to point the people towards him. They had become so comfortable in their identity and so in their own positions that when the real Messiah does arrive, it's a disaster for them. They want nothing less. And then the self-serving opposition continues, verse 49. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all." And that always cracks me up. Caiaphas was a Sadducee. Sadducees were famous in the first century for their unbelievable, constant rudeness. And you just see it here, very realistic. Ties in with other guys like Josephus and what they're saying about Sadducees. He was like Mr. Obnoxious. So he's like, "You guys know nothing at all. You must be glad I'm here." And he goes on, verse 50, "Nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." And there it is, a typical politician's ruthless pragmatism. He's saying, "Guys, let's just sacrifice him. Let's have an innocent man murdered instead of risking the Romans coming down on us," even though that wasn't a risk anyway. Hence, verse 53. It wasn't a risk because of Jesus, in any case. Ironically, the Romans do come down on them just one generation later, AD 70, as part of God's judgment. But that was never going to happen because of Jesus. He wasn't about that. So Caiaphas says that, and then you get verse 53. "So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death." And they've been trying to put him to death for a number of chapters already, but I think what that means is they say, enough is enough. We've got to stop talking. They intensify their efforts to finally nail this threat to their position. And there are just two applications I want to make briefly from this first point. And the first is this: don't be surprised. Don't be surprised. I mustn't be surprised when we see opposition to the gospel all around us to this day. And we mustn't be surprised when we face it ourselves. And I know here in the Bible Belt that opposition might be a little bit muted, but of course your work colleagues won't like it when, for the sake of honoring Christ, you respectfully refuse to join in with the obscene humor and the cruel gossip. And of course your fellow students won't like it when, for the sake of honoring Christ, you refuse to join in with bad-mouthing the teacher behind her back or helping them cheat in the exam. Of course, your friends won't like it. Your family will not like it when your version of Christianity, actually following Jesus practically, even when it's costly, makes their version of lukewarm, nominal, cultural Christianity look bad. As Jesus is about to teach us in John 15:20, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. And in this very evangelistic gospel of John, by highlighting the opposition Jesus went through, John's giving us the small print. He's saying, are you sure you want to follow Jesus? Really? Because if you do, you've got to realize this is what you're signing up to. This was the path of the guy that you want to follow in his footsteps. John's not hiding the small print. As the old saying goes, it's a dead fish that goes with the flow. It's a live fish that swims the other way. So there's one application. In the midst of opposition, don't be surprised. Don't be shocked. Don't be blindsided. Don't be naive. And in fact, if opposition happens, and sorry, when it happens, as the Bible promises it will, if we're being faithful followers of Jesus, if anything, be reassured, be encouraged. You're on the right track. You're following in his footsteps. So number one, don't be shocked. Final application under this first point, don't be sucked in. And this is less expected. And I think this is interesting and maybe more dangerous. Don't be sucked in. The second application. We might look at the Jewish leaders here and think, what a million miles we are from them. We could never, ever approach their mindset of wanting Jesus murdered and hating him that much. Never going to happen to me. The Jewish leaders seemed like they were the most passionate cheerleaders of all for the Messiah. That was their entire identity. They knew the scriptures way better than anyone else in that society. They never missed a service. But they did it all while actually doing it to serve themselves. It is easy to be like the Jewish leaders, to seem like we could be the most passionate cheerleaders of all for Christ, while deep down, maybe just subconsciously, doing it all actually to serve ourselves. So much so that we end up secretly kind of against the Messiah. The Messiah was a means to an end for the Jewish leaders to get what they really wanted, personal power and prestige and privilege. Could the Messiah sometimes become a means to an end for us to get what we really want deep down? I love running. I know we've got a few runners in the congregation. And imagine three runners. And they each run good length runs, 6 days a week. They never miss. They're equally committed. They're each in great shape. And you interview them one by one, and you ask them one question each. And the question is, why do you run? And you go up to the first guy. Why do you run? And he says, well, I run. My dad died of a heart attack, and I want to live longer, be around for my grandchildren. Great reason. You go to the second guy. Why do you run? And he says, well, I run so I can eat as much ice cream as I want and never gain weight. And also it makes me sleep better at night. Great reason as well. Then you go to the third guy. Why do you run? He says, I run because when I run, I love the feel of the wind on my face and the ground rushing past and the feeling of my heart and my lungs and my muscles exerting themselves and the feeling of my feet pounding on the turf. And I feel alive. Now, which of those three doesn't just use running as a means to an end, but actually loves running for the sake of running? First guy runs out of fear. Not saying that's bad, and probably quite sensible. Second guy runs for its benefits. And again, why shouldn't he? Great. But it's the third guy who runs because he actually loves running. They all three look the same. It's the third guy who really loves running. Now, yes, following Jesus delivers us from some very, very fearful things, both in this world and especially the world to come. And yes, following Jesus brings great benefits, again, in this world and especially the world to come. But in the end, are we following Jesus because we love Jesus? Are we following him for who he really is? that there didn't seem to be anyone more passionate about God and his Messiah than the Jewish leaders. And yet, in the end, it turned out, deep down, they were just serving themselves. So let's not be sucked into their mistake. And it's a pretty subtle one, but a super dangerous one. Which brings us to the second and final point more briefly, which is this: sovereign salvation. Sovereign salvation. We've looked into the face of the ugly, corrupt, self-serving opposition to Jesus. Now we get to rejoice in God's sovereign salvation. By sovereign, I just mean in wonderful control, totally, perfectly ruling over every detail, exactly as he wants it. Now let's go again from verse 50, where Caiaphas says, "Nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." So there's his callous, corrupt, self-serving, ruthless pragmatism again. Or is it? Or does he speak far truer than he realizes, with words ordained by that sovereign God for his mouth with a deeper meaning than he ever could have imagined? Verse 51, he did not say this of his own accord. But being high priest that year, he prophesied without realizing it that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. Caiaphas thinks he's hatching a cunning plan to destroy Jesus once and for all and protect his own position. He's actually giving a brilliant articulation of Jesus' own mission all along. In fact, Caiaphas' plan, far from stopping Jesus' plan, is exactly what God's using to fulfill Jesus' plan. Now who knows nothing at all? Don't you love the delicious irony? That's so John. And this is all a picture of the fact that even when Jesus' enemies are doing all they can to stop him in his tracks, all they're really doing is carrying out God's plan themselves. See, it's very foolish ever to take on God. He always wins. According to Revelation 13:8, Jesus' death was planned from before the world began. In Acts 4:27, just after the same Caiaphas had been persecuting the apostles after Jesus had been raised from the dead, he still hadn't learned, the believers pray the following words. Acts 4:27-28, they say, "Truly in this city, God, there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place." And here in John, Caiaphas not only predicts and ensures Jesus' death is going to happen, he even confirms some vital doctrine for us along the way. Thanks, Caiaphas. He says in verse 50 that one man will die, quote, "for the people, to stop the whole nation perishing." That is the truth of Jesus' substitutionary death. That is the truth of the substitutionary nature of his death, that he was our substitute, that he died in our place to save us from perishing under God's righteous wrath. Caiaphas thought he was talking about the Romans and people perishing that way, and God put those words in his mouth to articulate the truth that without Jesus as our substitute in our place, we will actually perish, not under the Romans, but under God's righteous wrath. So Jesus' death isn't just an example for us to teach us how to love one another, though it is that. We are meant to lay down our lives for each other as he laid down his life for us. His death isn't just a victory for us over sin and over Satan, though it is that as well. His death isn't just a demonstration for us of how much he loves us, or how serious sin is, or what God is like, though it is all of those things as well, and his death is loads of other things as well. But at its heart, according to Scripture, Jesus' death is an amazing substitution. So God can put truth in the mouth of even his most entrenched enemy. His word says, "The righteous for the unrighteous." Same word, gar in Greek, as Caiaphas' word, for. It's a substitution to bring us to God. And a lot of people love to kind of level out the pictures of what is happening when Jesus died and say, well, there's tons of them and we don't really know which is most important, and they're all important. That's not the biblical data. The biblical data is that at the heart is this critical concept of Jesus dying for us. And we mustn't lose that. God is pure and perfect. That means he can't tolerate even the slightest hint of evil. And our sin, therefore, condemns us to God's rightful justice, which is awful. But as well as being holy and just, it's also true that God loved the world, that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him, in other words, believes in his death in their place to pay for their sin, should not perish because he perished in their place, but have eternal life. And the prophet Isaiah, writing centuries earlier, put it like this. Listen out for this idea of substitution that a lot of people kind of find distasteful and like to just stick with the, well, it was an example and it was a demonstration and it was this and it was that. We can't get away from substitution. Isaiah was writing about this centuries earlier. Quote, he was pierced for our transgressions. Listen out for the idea of substitution again and again. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. With his wounds, we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned each one to his own way. Brilliant definition of sin. And the Lord has laid on him, because of our sin, the iniquity of us all. And according to verse 52 from John 11, this sacrificial, substitutionary death of Jesus was, quote, not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad, even as far flung as Knoxville, Tennessee. Fancy that. Even as far flung as the places around the globe where we currently have mission partners on three different continents. And it's Jesus' death that brings us in together, gathering us into one, verse 52. So it's his death that has us in this room tonight. It's his death which is the basis for the real love and commitment which I'm so privileged to watch in this little church family. Ernest Gordon was a writer and tells a story from World War II in his book Miracle on the River Kwai about Scottish prisoners forced by their Japanese captors to labor on a jungle railroad. And one afternoon, this incident happened. A shovel was missing. The officer in charge became enraged. He demanded that the missing shovel be produced by the prisoners or else. When nobody in the squad budged, the officer got his gun and threatened to kill them all on the spot. It was obvious the officer meant what he had said. Then finally, one man stepped forward. The officer put away his gun, picked up a shovel, and beat the man to death. When it was over, the survivors picked up the bloody corpse and carried it with them to the second tool check. This time, no shovel was missing. There had been a miscount. Well, we too have experienced that substitutionary death, and it has saved our lives. But there's more, because the writer Ernest Gordon goes on, the word spread like wildfire through the whole camp. An innocent man had been willing to die to save others. The incident had a profound effect. Having descended into barbarity, even towards each other, the men began treating each other like brothers. See the unifying effect of that sacrifice. Not only did Jesus' death save our lives, it's also gathered us into one. So we don't even have to just treat each other like brothers and sisters, we become brothers and sisters. So anyway, Caiaphas makes this prophecy without realizing it. They agreed to put Jesus to death, 53, which leads to verse 54. We're nearly done, but 54. Jesus therefore no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there to the region near the wilderness, .. He's now avoiding the Jews, not because he isn't sovereign, but precisely because he is. Because although he's going to let them kill him as part of his plan all along, it's going to be on his timing, not theirs. Now, why does that matter? Well, it matters because his timing is to die not then, but in about a week's time. Why a week's time? And the answer is the third word of verse 55. Verse 55, third word. It's very deliberate. The annual high point of the Jewish year is in about a week. Guess who the real ultimate Passover lamb is, to whom all the centuries' worth of Passover lambs have been pointing to all along? The timing is just going to be perfect. Just as Passover lambs are being slaughtered all over Jerusalem, we're going to see at the same time the Passover lamb also being slaughtered to provide purification for sin for his people. Hence, verse 55. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand in about 6 days, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. So in all of this, we see God's totally unstoppable, life-saving, unity-bringing, sovereign salvation, perfectly ordained from before the foundation of the world. Which means, as I finish, that we have a God who is all-powerful, whose plans are unstoppable, whose saving love for his people is invincible, whose purification of his people is impeccable, and a God to whom we can entrust our souls. Have you done that?